It's called presidential harassment.
I want nothing.
And it's unfortunate.
I want no quid pro quo.
This should never, ever happen to another president, ever.
I don't know. I haven't spoken to Rudy. I spoke to him yesterday briefly. He's a very good attorney, and he has been my attorney. Yeah, sure.
Shut up,
Rudy.
Moron.
Rudy.
Shut up.
Okay, hold on.
Shut up.
Hold on.
You don't know what you're talking about.
What they've done to General Flynn.
Russia, Russia, Russia.
What they've done to others.
It was all bull.
This is Josh Barrow, host of KCRW's Left, Right, and Center. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers, the podcast about President Trump's legal issues. And Ken White is with me. Ken is my co-host, a criminal defense attorney and former federal prosecutor. He blogs at popehat.com. Hello, Ken.
Hello, Josh.
So the president has made a number of comments in the past week suggesting that he's playing favorites among the states amid the coronavirus outbreak. He said this about state governors at a briefing. All I want them to do, very simple. I want them to be appreciative. I don't want them to say things that aren't true. I want them to be appreciative. We've done a great job. To that end, California Governor Gavin Newsom has actually been succeeding quite well at playing nice with Trump, despite them being in different political parties. But Trump says he's been having a lot of trouble with, quote, that woman in Michigan. That means Governor Gretchen Whitmer, who has been widely discussed as a possible vice presidential nominee. He said in an interview with Sean Hannity last Thursday, we've had a big problem with this, with the young, a woman governor from, you know who I'm talking about, from Michigan. She's a new governor and it's not been pleasant. He added, she doesn't get it done and we send her a lot. Now she wants a declaration of emergency and, you know, we'll have to make a decision on that. So there's the implicit threat. A federal emergency declaration frees up certain relief funds for states. Trump did, in fact, end up issuing that declaration for Michigan on Saturday. I guess my first question is, Trump seems to have recognized that being seen as playing favorites among states could be a political liability. Michigan, after all, is a swing state after there was a tension on his feud with Governor Whitmer. He seems to have backed off of it a little bit, giving out that emergency declaration. But aside from that political restriction, is there any legal restriction on his ability to play favorites among states? I mean, the president, there are a number of areas where he has really wide executive discretion. Can anyone sue, you know, say the administration has been making decisions about sending personal protective equipment or anything else for political reasons and that's, you know, that is an illegitimate use of the president's authorities?
No, Josh, almost certainly no. And this is a question that's coming up in a increasingly large number of contexts as people want to sue the president for rolling out the response to the coronavirus badly or saying things that aren't true or giving bad advice. The answer to almost all of these is no, that you can't personally sue the president for this type of thing. The president enjoys extremely broad immunity for acts done in his official capacity, acts that are done within areas where he has power, and he can't be sued for those things. This goes back quite a while to a Supreme Court case called Nixon versus Fitzgerald. So Fitzgerald was in the Air Force and gave some testimony before Congress in a whistleblower matter, and Nixon had him fired, had him demoted and discharged. And what the Supreme Court said is that the president of the United States, in exercising the president's power, is immune from suit. And so if something is within what the court called the outside perimeter of the president's powers, then he enjoys absolute immunity from any type of suit, unless Congress has passed some sort of law specifically imposing liability. So here, whether it's the president in the United States exercising executive discretion about whether or not to declare emergencies or how to distribute limited resources, those are things within the broad perimeters of the president's authority. So he's going to be immune unless there's a specific congressional statute. Same thing most likely with the president saying things in his capacity as president, giving bad advice, telling people it's just a flu, no big deal. All of this stuff falls into the president's general power to talk to the nation and is likely immune from suit.
What about the chloroquine phosphate stuff? I mean, there's this one horrible case, this couple in Arizona that took a non-pharmaceutical version of this that's used for cleaning fish tanks after the president had been talking up this, you know, speculative, maybe promising, but, you know, still very much within trials treatment. Chloroquine phosphate is a malarial treatment, but it can have some pretty nasty side effects. And the president president has been sort of, you know, eagerly pitching that this is going to be the thing that is likely to you know, really save us from this outbreak. Does the president have any sort of liability if people, you know, take that advice and end up doing reckless things because of what he and people in the media are saying?
Again, for the president, almost certainly not. So long as we accept the proposition that the president's powers include speaking with the nation, talking about national crises, things like that, and that's almost certainly the case, then the president, again, enjoys that type of broad legal immunity for his actions. So the inquiry isn't whether or not it was bad advice or reckless or unscientific or stupid. The inquiry is more broadly whether the president has the power to speak to the nation and talk about how to address crises before the nation. And if a court accepts that that is within his broad power as president, then he's immune from suit over having given that advice.
What about other people who give bad advice? Is there legal liability for that sort of thing? I mean, it's different, right, from like if I hire you to be my tax lawyer and you give me bad advice on tax law and it gets me into trouble with the IRS, you know, you had some sort of fiduciary responsibility to me. You know, people, talking heads in the media who give out bad advice, can they have any legal liability from that?
Only in a very limited sense. So you're right to suggest, Josh, that liability for advice usually centers around some sort of relationship. So whether it's legal advice or medical advice, the inquiry is usually, did you form some sort of legal or medical relationship with this person? Was it enough when the person asked the doctor at the party what they should do to create some sort of responsibility on behalf of the doctor? And this is why doctors and lawyers are often reluctant to give free advice, because they're worried about it creating the type of relationship where they're potentially liable. In general, people in the media don't have that type of relationship with their audience and don't have any sort of legal responsibility to them. When you're talking about the media, you have the added layer of the First Amendment, which would be a barrier in general to suing people in the media for stating their views on how to respond to a disaster. That's protected by the First Amendment, and the idea that it was lousy advice is not a First Amendment exception. So it would be very difficult or impossible to have a successful suit against any particular network or individual in the news because their advice led people to delay responsible approaches to the pandemic.
We talked a little bit about the president's protection from suits against him in his personal capacity for things that he does as president. But what about suits against government entities? Could you, for example, sue a state government because it failed to close schools or businesses early enough and the COVID outbreak got more out of control than it otherwise would have been, and maybe you got COVID and otherwise you would not have gotten it?
Well, state governments and parts of state governments generally have broad sovereign immunity, except when it's been waived. So that's going to come down to which laws you attempt to apply. So there may be a variety of federal or state laws under which local governments have failed to live up to their obligations, but it's going to be a lot harder than people think. The law simply isn't set up to address failures on this scale, unfortunately.
And then on the flip side, does the government have any liability for the costs that are imposed by the anti-outbreak measures? Now, obviously, I mean, we just had this $2 trillion plus bill passed, and the government is discretionarily giving out very large amounts of aid to offset the costs that this pandemic and the response to it is going to impose on the economy. But, you know, I mean, the Constitution says the government has to compensate you for takings of your property. If the government orders you to close your restaurant because of a pandemic, does the government owe you anything for that order?
No, because again, the government, particularly state governments, have very broad power to respond to pandemics. And so that's not going to be the type of taking that's going to trigger the obligation to pay. Now, I'm sure you will see some lawsuits aimed at that, but I think they're very unlikely to be successful. One of the hottest areas of takings clause litigation over the years has been regulatory takings. That is the concept that, you know, it, does the government take your property if it creates regulations that limit what you can do on that property, whether environmental or zoning or others? And a discussion of that law would put all our listeners to sleep. But suffice it to say that when you have a very temporary, relatively narrow in scope and related to a disaster type of situation like this one, it's very unlikely to be the sort of taking that requires compensation.
I want to talk about how this is bleeding into the presidential campaign, which is to say that President Trump's campaign has been sending cease and desist letters to television stations, telling them not to run a super PAC ad that is critical of the president's handling of the coronavirus outbreak. The ad from Priorities USA Action juxtaposes the rising coronavirus case count with the president's early comments that dismissed the magnitude of the threat. The letter objects to the ad's use of tape of the president saying this is their new hoax at a campaign rally in February. The campaign says it is clear in context that the president was calling Democratic claims that he has mishandled the crisis a hoax, that he was not calling the coronavirus outbreak itself a hoax. And the letter warns, among other matters, that television stations can lose their broadcast licenses for airing deceptive ads. So I guess, first, we should note, anyone can send a cease and desist letter about anything. People talk about it as though this were some sort of formal legal document, like an injunction or something. Really, you know, anyone can send an angry letter, right?
Absolutely. And it's legally meaningless most of the time. And it's often just a gesture. It could be a signal to the base. Look how strong we are. Look how we're fighting against the lying mainstream media. Sometimes, frankly, it's a client control measure. You send the stupid letter so that you don't have to file the stupid lawsuit. It's a way to calm down the client and make the client feel that you've done something muscular and aggressive against the other side. But this legal threat, like a number of them by the Trump campaign, is completely meritless. It's, you know, very argumentative spin on why the campaign ad is misleading is not anything that has any legal validity. It seems almost entirely a campaign ad itself, like a number of the lawsuits and legal threats that we see these days.
Is the ad deceptive by any relevant legal standard? Now, I think that you can look at it from a journalistic standard and say that, yeah, if you read the president in context, it seems like what he's saying is that the criticisms of his administration over its handling are a hoax. But the ad doesn't say President Trump called the coronavirus a hoax. It strings together a number of clips of the president talking, and it is very clear from the ad that they are different clips of the president talking in different contexts, because he's basically shouting this hoax thing because it was a statement at a rally. The other sound clips are from press interviews where the president is speaking in a very different tone. Do you have any legal obligation to provide that useful context around quotes of your political opponent?
You don't. And you could only say this is misleading, I think, under the most argumentative approach to it. It's the difference between saying that the virus is the hoax and saying that the Democrats' emphasis on the virus is a hoax, I think, is a distinction without a lot of relevant difference, particularly as the flaws in the administration's rollout of response to the pandemic became more and more obvious, and things that the president said in February become increasingly walked back by the administration. So every day that goes by, I think that the president's read of this gets weaker and weaker. There is no obligation in general to avoid, you know, cheap shots or argumentative presentations of what the other person said, or taking somewhat out of context. All that is very typical of political ads.
I think it's important to note, in the context of the next thing we're going to talk about, that this letter didn't go to Priorities USA Action. It didn't tell the opposing group stop running this ad. It went to the TV stations that were being hired to run the ad, and it included a statement that that those stations could lose their broadcast licenses if they broadcast misleading advertising. And that seems relevant in the context of a lawsuit brought by a group called PEN America, This is a membership organization for writers and journalists. They say that the president has infringed on free speech rights by threatening media organizations in various ways and by taking retaliatory actions against those that report negatively on him. The president moved to have this lawsuit dismissed. He was arguing basically that PEN America lacked standing to sue over several of the things it complained about. For example, they tried to sue over the president threatening Amazon that he would try to adjust postal rates for packages because he was upset with coverage from the Washington Post, which is owned by Amazon founder Jeff Bezos. This case will go forward on some of the matters that PEN America sued over. They sued over the revocation temporarily of CNN reporter Jim Acosta's White House press pass. Acosta is a member of PEN America. They're also going to be allowed to proceed with the lawsuit over the president revoking and threatening to revoke security clearances of former officials who are critical of him. Can you explain the standing issues in this lawsuit, what PEN America is and is not being allowed to sue over?
Sure. Remember, standing is a jurisdictional doctrine. It's a way for particularly federal courts to limit what issues they will or won't decide on. And it's a way to limit the courts from getting involved in every single aspect of life more than they already are. So the basic idea is if you're not directly harmed by an action, then you can't sue over it. Josh, that's what prevents you and I from ruling the nation by getting into arguments over what policy is right or wrong and then running to court and asking the court to resolve it for us. If we're not personally harmed by some law or policy or action, we can't sue over it and ask the court to decide how it should come out. Here, PEN America was taking a rather scattershot approach to a number of somewhat bullying things the administration was doing, from revoking press passes to threatening to revoke security clearances, to taking cheap shots at Jeff Bezos and suggesting maybe we'll put more postage on Amazon packages because I don't like the Washington Post, to threatening even broadcasting licenses. And the court went through these item by item and said, okay, PEN America, an organization of journalists, is directly harmed, arguably, by revoking White House press passes and by threatening to take away security clearances that would have the same impact. But these other things are not directly harmed by. Washington Post has to sue over the threat about Amazon. Broadcasters have to sue over the threat to revoke broadcast licenses. So those things were not going on. But for now, we are going to move forward on these threats to White House press passes and other things that PEN's members are directly harmed by. And that's just an example of courts, and especially federal courts, being somewhat conservative in what they will or won't take up out of an idea that we don't want to get dragged into resolving every single question ever.
And so it was interesting to me that the nature of the harms was different with these two issues. With the press passes, the idea is that this is a restriction on Jim Acosta's free speech, the president punishing him for what he says in or around these press briefings. With regard to the security clearances, the harm is different. It's about restricting the ability of PEN America's members to receive speech, which is to say that the president's actions around security clearances appear to be designed to discourage certain people from talking to the press. And so the way PEN America is harmed, it doesn't have to do with anything that PEN America members would say. It's about things that could be said to members of PEN America.
True. But it's an interesting illustration of how that can still harm PEN America, in the sense that even if it's not being directly restricted itself, the end result is restricting what information it can get and therefore how its members can report on stories.
And so, this is just an early stage, right? They have shown that they have claims here that the court could consider. They haven't actually demonstrated yet that they were harmed. That would be a matter for trial?
Right, and discovery first. So this is the very earliest part of the case. This simply means that the case can go forward to the extent that any civil case is currently going forward in the United States.
Let's take a quick break, and when we come back, we can talk about Attorney General Bill Barr. You're listening to All the President's Lawyers. This is Josh Barrow, and I'm back with Attorney Ken White on All the President's Lawyers. So, Ken, another week into the crisis, can you give a sense of what the federal court system is doing? Are you seeing more consistency, more clarity about what business is going forward and what's being postponed and how?
Yes. As we look at different cases in different federal courts, you're seeing pretty much a blanket shutdown of hearings in person. You're seeing different courts taking different approaches to whether they're simply going to kick the can down the road and not hold any hearings, or whether they're going to move to telephonic hearings. Some courts, like bankruptcy courts, are more likely to move into a lot more telephonic hearings. Other courts are simply saying we're not going to be hearing anything except emergencies. Criminal cases, of course, need to move forward because the defendants have constitutional rights. Those are increasingly being limited to a narrower range of courtrooms and courthouses, and non-essential events are being delayed and put off. So I think the federal courts, as a rule, were a little slower out of the gate than the state courts in dealing with this, possibly because of the volume issues are different. But you're seeing a more coordinated and uniform approach across the country. That means, especially if you're in a civil case, you're not going to be in a courtroom anytime soon.
And then there's the issue of prisons. One thing that people are very concerned about is that prisons are crowded and in some cases unsanitary, and it's difficult to implement and follow the social distancing guidelines that are intended to stop the spread of this disease. And so we've seen a couple of steps that the federal government is taking in this regard. One is a two-week lockdown of federal prison facilities to try to reduce the interpersonal contacts. And then the other is the Attorney General has directed the Bureau of Prisons to release certain old and sick inmates to home confinement to reduce their risk of exposure to COVID-19 in custody. What do you make of the steps that the federal government is taking trying to address the concerns about an outbreak in prisons?
Josh, these are really extremely minimal steps. I would say more gestures than anything else. The lockdown is simply a 14-day, let's let people out of their cells even less often than they usually do type of situation. So it's just simply saying that people need to stay in their individual cells, almost like solitary confinement, and we're dramatically limiting the normal activities that you'd have access to, like being in common areas for recreation or meals or things like that. So you're still in the prison. You still have some inevitable contact with other people, and it doesn't do much other than shut people into their individual cells for that period of time. Attorney General Barr's memo about releasing people, again, is pretty much the bare minimum. What you have to understand is the Bureau of Prisons has a lot of discretion in how it has you serve your sentence. So it's not that if you're sentenced to 10 years, you step into one prison on day one and you step out on the last day of 10 years. The Bureau of Prisons has discretion to move you and to step down your level of confinement as circumstances warrant. A lot of the time, it's a matter of overcrowding or resources. So it's not unusual for one of my clients to start out a 1 or 2 or 3 year prison sentence for something, and towards the end, the last 6 months, they may be moved to a halfway house, which is someplace where, you know, it's not a lockdown and you can go out and work during the day and you come back at the end of the day. And then sometimes even to be stepped down to home confinement for a very final period of their sentence. All the Attorney General really did here was remind the Bureau of Prisons they have that discretion and urge them to use it to step some limited number of people down to a home confinement component of their sentence, which the Bureau of Prisons can do. So it was really not a dramatic change. It was just telling the Bureau of Prisons to think about that. And meaningfully, it didn't give the Bureau of Prisons any more resources than it already has. So it's a big job to do the analysis to figure out who's suitable for this, who's eligible, who can be stepped down. And they don't have any more resources to do that than they did yesterday. So I'm not sure it's really going to have a meaningful impact.
The Attorney General had been scheduled to give testimony before the House Judiciary Committee. That testimony has now been postponed, like a lot of other things. There's this ongoing debate about whether the Constitution allows Congress to meet and vote virtually. There are some members who would really like to do that, but there's been resistance, including because of that constitutional concern. But it seems to me there should be no reason why a committee hearing could not be conducted over Zoom, right? So why would his testimony need to be postponed? Couldn't that be something that would be done virtually?
Yeah, but the thing is, they haven't put the rules in place to permit that. So the Constitution itself doesn't necessarily require many things to be done in real life in person. So certainly that was the assumption at the time the Constitution was enacted. But Congress has the right to make its own rules about how it proceeds, and those rules could provide for virtual meetings. But right now they do not, and it's a question of whether or not Congress or parts of Congress would pass such rules. You know, as a matter of fact, in the wake of 9/11, a lot of people were urging some sort of continuity of government plans that would permit for exactly this type of thing. So I spoke on a podcast with Norm Ornstein from the American Enterprise Institute about this. After 9/11, he was pushing a lot of continuity of government plans that would allow things like replacing Supreme Court justices quickly, or a more secure line of succession, or congressional gatherings and quorums virtually. Unfortunately, all those were largely ignored. And so now we're here in this circumstance where we would like to be able to do things like have Congress vote without all of them getting into one big room. But we haven't done the work ahead of time.
You would think that Barr would be eager to do his appearance right around now, in the sense that, I mean, it's a good time to do any kind of news dump. There are a lot of questions to ask him specifically about the coronavirus crisis. That is what is at the top of mind for everyone. And so that means what's not at the top of mind is, you know, certain decisions that have been made in the department where it looks like the thumb is on the scale to protect people close to Donald Trump from the usual hammer of the criminal justice system.
Yeah, I'm not sure if this is about Bill Barr not wanting to do it or Congress not wanting to do it. Congress certainly does not want to be seen, I think, to be holding a hearing like this during this crisis, because I think that plays very easily into the president's attempted narrative that, you know, impeachment and Ukraine and Mueller were all distractions. And, you know, if I had not been distracted, I could have responded better to this crisis. And it would probably be very unseemly to most people and would play into the notion that this is a political attack on the president rather than a legitimate inquiry. So even if Barr were willing to do it, I don't think Congress would want to do it now, and I think they'd be right.
Finally, let's talk about Michael Avenatti. Prosecutors have objected to his request to be released on bail pending his two remaining criminal trials. COVID-19 does not demand the mass release of healthy pretrial detainees, say prosecutors in their response. His trial in Orange County on charges that he stole money from clients has been delayed on account of coronavirus from May until August. There's also going to be another trial in New York. That one's about stealing Stormy Daniels' book advance, and both sides have requested that that trial also be delayed to July. So it sounds like they have a pretty good argument here, right? That, you know, even though Avenatti once had pneumonia, he hasn't demonstrated that in his currently apparently healthy condition, that he has, you know, a particular medical concern compared to other people who might be detained pretrial.
That's true. But the judge in here in California is taking it very seriously. The first approach in New York as well, we're given sort of the back of the hand. But now Judge Selna here in Orange County in California has sort of set out a series of questions that he wants Avenatti's attorneys to address. And those were questions like, well, if he were let out, where would he stay? And shouldn't he be quarantined for a while first to make sure he's not bringing anything from lockup out? And how do you make sure he doesn't engage in financial transactions? Avenatti's attorneys are in the process of responding to that order. So it seems as if the judge has softened somewhat
on this issue. And I don't think that it's anything about Avenatti being sympathetic, because the judge's order says rather bluntly, remember, I'm the guy who put him in because I found that he was a financial danger to the public, and that has to be addressed. Instead, I think that the judge is particularly concerned by the evidence that there's an outbreak at the Metropolitan Correction Center where Avenatti is, and concerned for his well-being. And let's face it, Avenatti is not the most sympathetic figure ever. But Josh, what I think is disturbing about this is not at all that one person might be released, but that so many other people might not be. I mean, this is a person who has, or at least appears to have, the resources to have very good lawyers make very persuasive arguments, and the ability to respond to a judicial order that has, you know, respond to these 10 arguments and maybe I'll let you out. The vast majority of people who are in lockup don't have those resources, don't have those lawyers, don't have any chance of this type of argument. And that's very disturbing. So it's looking to me as if Avenatti may get out temporarily. The judge has said very specifically, this would be a 90-day thing and then you're back in. But I'm much more concerned about all the other people who don't have the ability to make this argument.
Those resources that you described that Avenatti has, weren't those also part of the problem last time he was out on bail? That, you know, the availability of those resources was what enabled him to engage in various financial chicanery that violated his previous bail terms. I mean, if you're Avenatti's lawyer, how do you make the argument that, you know, for real, he's going to follow the rules around his bail this time?
Well, that's a good question. And that's something that the judge's order specifically asks the defense to address. And what the defense seems to be doing is saying that he won't engage in any financial transactions at all, and that will all be controlled by his defense.
Well, there is much more for us to talk about, but I think that's a good place for us to leave it this week. Ken White, thank you for speaking with me.
Thank you, as always, Josh.
If you have questions about the president's lawyers and his legal issues, please send them to us. You can find us on Twitter at LRCKCRW. You can also leave us voicemail at 424-538-8888. All the President's Lawyers is produced by Sarah Fay. Our technical director is JC Swadek. Todd M. Simon composed our theme music. I'm Josh Barrow. Thanks for joining us. And Ken and I will be back next week with more All the President's Lawyers.